Welcome, everybody. This is Lecture 4 of the Mises Academy online class, The Economics of the Great Depression. Today is December 7th, 2012, a day that will live in infamy among Depression lectures. And the topic for today is the New Deal, Fascism Prolongs the Depression. So you can see the outline we're going over. As always, if you've got questions, put them in the Q&A part of the screen or of your interface there so we can keep them segregated. Okay, let me, on this first slide here called causal chain, let me just run down what I'm viewing as the Austrian position. On all of these events, because it's you want to be careful with your language. You don't want to leave yourself open to an obvious rebuttal. So let me just motivate this by saying the sort of thing that I want you to watch out for. There's things. Let me see if this is the day I ended up doing this. Yeah, see, they even kind of changed the cover, the copy on my book here. It's not terrible, but they tweaked it because they wanted to make it more about attacking FDR. So what you don't want to do is say the New Deal caused the Depression, because if you say that, you're dead in the water, because someone's going to say, wait a minute, the Depression started, you know, depending on how, when you make the do the timing, but clearly by 1930 we were in the Depression. Certainly by 1931 and 32, we were in the Depression, and Roosevelt didn't even get elected until late 32. So, and you know, so the New Deal didn't start until March of 1933 at best. And so, what are you talking about? FDR caused the Great Depression, right? And I've seen internet Austrians get, not even just Austrians, like free market types, overstep and say things like that. And then another thing that's a little bit inaccurate is when you say, oh, according to the Austrians, the Federal Reserve caused the Great Depression. That's more defensible, but again, it's you got to be careful about what the claim is. So here is what I would say, and I think probably most Austrians would generally endorse what I'm about to say to you. You know, perhaps a little tweaks here and there, but I think they would go for this general categorization of the various causes and effects. So, for sure, the standard Austrian position is that the Fed, that's what that building is supposed to be, the Federal Reserve, that the Fed caused the 1920s boom. And then, as Austrian business cycle theory says, if there is an unsustainable boom, there has to be a bust. So you could say the Fed is responsible for the 1929 crash. You could also say that the Fed's inflation of the 1920s led to mail investments, setting up an inevitable crash, and that the timing also you could say was due to the Fed, that because the Fed eased off on its monetary inflation in, you know, we didn't talk about this too much in this course. Rothbard may get into it a little bit, and certainly if you go read Milton Friedman and other monetarists, remember where they are coming from is they're looking at the Fed's policies during the 20s, and they're going to note a change in 28 and 29. They're going to say, wait a second, certain indicators of business confidence and, you know, tightness in the credit markets and whatever, things look like they were starting to get a little bit dicey there, and the Fed didn't just pump in more inflation the way they had done, the way it had done earlier in the 20s. Every time there was a hiccup during the boom in the 20s, the Fed would just inflate its way through it, and that's what kept the boom going. And so the monetarists, I think the monetarists have a point that if you want to understand why did the stock market crash happen in 1929, how come it didn't happen in 1926, or how come it didn't happen in 1933, I think the immediate cause was the Fed did tighten up, at least relatively speaking, compared to what it had been doing earlier in the 20s. And so the monetarists have a modest point, but of course the big difference is a Rothbardian versus a Milton Friedman-esque perspective. Rothbard would say, following Mises, once you start the credit expansion, it's inevitable there's going to be a crash, that there has to be a bust. Now, the only question is, when is it going to be? And it's true, Mises says, the banks, the ones that are ultimately the spigot, the gatekeepers, the one pumping in more credit into the economy, they're the ones that can affect the timing. When the banks all of a sudden get more conservative and they stop pumping in as much money and that makes interest rates rise, that's when the crash is going to happen. And remember that I even gave you that quote from Mises. I think it was in lecture one, maybe lecture two, I'm not sure, where Mises says, in a sense, if you want to say the crash is due to the banks or the banks caused the crash, that's fine, but just realize it's not that a crash is only happening because of the banks. It's not that if the banks kept that inflation going indefinitely, just ignoring all the warning signs, ignoring the fact that price inflation is getting out of control and that they have to keep pumping in ever larger injections of new money into the credit markets to keep nominal interest rates from rising too much. Because once prices start rising, people start building in purchasing power components into the nominal interest rate. You know what I'm saying? So if the Fed in the 20s had just kept inflating, so the stock market didn't crash in 29, well, eventually prices would have started rising. If every time the economy seemed like it was faltering and sputtering, if the Fed just kept printing money and injecting it until things all of a sudden went back to prosperity, apparent prosperity, they could do that. But the point is, because there were underlying real imbalances, in order to keep the illusion going, you'd have to keep pumping in more and more money. And that eventually is going to make prices rise. And then once the public starts expecting it as a normal course of affairs, the prices are going to be rising at 5, 6, 7, 8% per year, then the interest rate in the loan market is going to start rising just on that account alone. And so the point is, in order to perpetually keep interest rates down, the Fed or the banking sector as a whole is going to have to pump in more and more money, rising exponentially, just to stay ahead of that trend. And that is what happens in places that have hyperinflation. Now, the motivation is different. So it's in interwar Germany and in Zimbabwe. I don't think the central banks there were acting just as, engineers trying to keep the economy afloat. I think they were paying the government's bills by running the printing press. And that's what ended up happening there. But the point is, runaway printing of money can only have the result of eventually the currency collapses. And then once that happens, the banks are powerless to keep the boom going because, the mechanism they use by pumping in more money, well, if the public's not accepting that money anymore, the banks can't do it anymore. And so then the crash occurs, and of course it's far worse since the boom has been kept going much longer in this new scenario where we're saying, what if the banks just kept inflating until the currency collapsed? So back to our story here with this causal chain, I'm saying for sure you could say the Fed caused the 20s boom. You could even say they caused the 1929 crash, even in the sense of the timing. So that given what the Fed inflated in the 20s, there was going to be a crash. And you could even blame the Fed for when the crash happened. And so that's all fine in terms of an Austrian perspective. And you can even say that there would have been a depression with a small d. Because part of what happened is after the Great Depression, by definition, we don't have depressions anymore. Now they're recessions. And actually, I haven't been able to quite pin this down, but I got the sense from reading some things that the very term depression was itself a euphemism. That before that, they used to call them panics. Right? If you think back, you can recall reading historical treatments, the panic of such and such year, where this was the depression, and you might say, well, what's the difference? And there could be some types of differences, like legitimate differences, but I think one of the differences was that Hoover didn't want to get up there and refer to it in his press conferences as a panic. And so a depression, actually, think about it, if you didn't know, if you hadn't been brought up to learn of the Great Depression as the worst thing ever, the term depression doesn't sound as bad as a panic, does it, in terms of economics or finance? A panic sounds awful. It sounds like an emergency. Oh, there's a panic going on. I got to do something. Whereas depression just kind of sounds like, oh, the economy is underperforming. And then to take it even further, the new euphemism, of course, is recession, which is what we call them now. So, I don't think that's completely a coincidence. I think that there's definitely people who do not want us to call, like, this current thing that we're in right now, they call it the Great Recession. And some of that is cheeky, but I think it's also that since we have all of these allegedly counter-cyclical policies and mechanisms in place that were put in place during the 1930s, we're not supposed to have depressions anymore, by definition. Those are things caused by the free market. Now that we have all this big government, social safety net, people at the Fed are armed with Keynesian macroeconomics, we should never have a depression again. So the thing that started in 2007 or 2008, whenever you want to time it, by definition, that can't be a depression because we don't have those anymore. Depressions are the things that markets cause. So that's what some cynical people might say. But what I'm pointing out is the very term depression is a euphemism because they used to call them panics. Okay. So that's what you could say there, that the Fed's activities caused the expansion, the boom of the 20s, the crash, even the timing of the crash, and then the fact that there was going to be a depression with a small d, just like there had been before. And even there, we got to be careful. It's not the Fed per se. It's fractional reserve banking, but once there's a central bank in place, it cartelizes the banks and coordinates it. So the Fed sort of harnesses the danger of fractional reserve banking and amplifies it. Okay. So then is it correct to say the Federal Reserve, according to the Austrians, caused the Great Depression? Not really, because when we talk about the Great Depression, we mean the absolutely awful economic performance and the severity of the Depression and the fact that it was so unbearably long. So the layperson, when you say, what do you think the Great Depression refers to, will probably think, oh, the whole 1930s were just awful until World War II. And that's what the Great Depression is. And that's fine. Or if you ask a professional economist, he might say, oh, well, actually, what we call the Great Depression is two separate periods. There was the Great Contraction from 1929 to 33, and then there was another relapse from 37 to 38 or 39, depending on how you time the thing. All right, so there was like a double dip. So the point is, looking at certain conventional statistics, there was an apparent recovery from basically when Roosevelt took over up until 37. It looked like the economy was recovering, and then, oh, shoot, the economy fell back into a major depression in 37, 38. All right, so the point is, however you classify, whatever you mean by the Great Depression, either way, that's not the fault of the Fed. That the reason, even just taking the narrow definition from 1929 to 33, that is not the Fed's fault. The fact that there was going to be a depression with a small D is the Fed's fault, but the reason it was so awful and lasted so long, the reason unemployment got so high and so forth, was Herbert Hoover's fault, again, in the standard Austrian worldview. And then, so what did FDR do? What did the New Deal do? It prolonged the Great Depression. And so that's why the title of this lecture that I gave you is that if the New Deal prolongs the Depression. So, you know, don't say the New Deal caused the Great Depression, because that's crazy. The New Deal didn't even start until 1933. So how can we say these things? Well, looking at previous boom-bust cycles, and there's disputes about how long are they, and it matters what kind of data you look at and stuff like that, but I think it's a fair summary to say that most of the panics or depressions with a small d in U.S. history before this point, the worst had been over by the first 2 years. And so you would expect if the federal government had done nothing and if the Federal Reserve had just done what, say, Bagehot recommended and lent to institutions that were very creditworthy, had good collateral, and lent at a penalty rate, you know, so looked at what the market rate of interest was and then charged banks or institutions that wanted to borrow from the Fed at a rate above what people could get in the marketplace, then presumably by 1931, the U.S. economy would have been fine again, just like the Depression of 1920 and 21 was over within 2 years, and it paved the way for an extremely rapid recovery. All right, so that's the way I would explain it, that in the Austrian view, the Fed made a bust inevitable, but Herbert Hoover made things much worse than they had to be and made the process drag out far longer than it otherwise would have. And we talked in the last lecture about the sorts of things he did and why. And then FDR comes along and just makes it a lot worse. And so that's why you get an entire decade of just absolute misery. And there's various measures you can look at to show just how awful the 1930s were. Okay, an irony is in the 32 election, so remember, it's there every 4 years, so Calvin Coolidge, remember, got sworn in because he had been the vice president, and then Harding died in office, and then Coolidge becomes the president. Then he ran for office officially in, 1924. And so Coolidge, you know, gets the American people vote for Calvin Coolidge as president in the 1924 election, whereas they hadn't voted for him before. And he wins. And then he serves out the rest of that term. And then in the 28 election, Herbert Hoover is the Republican and he wins. And then he gets sworn in March of 1929. And then the poor guy, sitting there minding his own business, and you have the worst stock crash in world history happening when he's not even been in office a year. So, and then, so remember what Hoover does. I'm just reviewing here from the last class. So Hoover, right after the stock market crash in late 1929, calls all of his advisors together. They hash it out, and according to Hoover's own memoirs, Treasury Secretary Mellon, who had served under Harding and Coolidge and was responsible for pushing through those very large income tax rate reductions and presumably had a lot to do with the fact that the government ran a balance, but a surplus actually, every year in the 1920s, Mellon is telling Hoover, don't do anything. So let this thing blow itself up. Yeah, it'll be painful for a while, but we'll hit rock bottom really fast and the economy will turn around. just like it has in the past. You know, and, so this wasn't some crazy, again, assuming Mellon actually said this stuff. Some people dispute whether Mellon said it, because remember, this isn't coming from Mellon's diary or something. This is Herbert Hoover in a self-serving part of his memoirs trying to convince the reader, hey, don't look at me. I did everything I could when I was president. In fact, I ignored the advice of that hard-hearted Treasury Secretary Andrew Mellon. Okay, so given the context, it's conceivable that Hoover either unintentionally or intentionally misrepresented what Mellon had actually said to him. But the point is, I had no problem with what Mellon said if that's what he said. And I would have said the same thing. So assuming that's what Mellon said, it was perfectly accurate advice. And he wasn't just grasping at theoretical straws. He was pointing at U.S. history and saying, the federal government hasn't done anything ever before, and look what happens. Things are bad for a while, they hit bottom, they turn around. There's nothing we can do. Liquidate stocks, liquidate labor, liquidate whatever. So so Hoover says, no, we're not going to do that. And then if you read the Rothbard material, or if you have my Depression book, I had lots of excerpts in there, you can see that Hoover in his speeches and in his policies, which we can document from looking at the government's budget and stuff like that, increased spending. And then in particular what he did, so he increased spending even as tax revenues were falling off a cliff and as the general price level, or if you don't like that term, the array of prices, was moving downward. All right. So the reason that's significant is it's one thing to increase spending while tax revenues are going up and there's price inflation so that the real purchasing power of the dollar keeps falling. And so there, you know, but if you're increasing spending at the same time that revenues are dropping very rapidly and the dollar's getting stronger, then there's a sense that you're really determined to raise spending. I mean, in other words, you're like swimming against two different currents in that respect. And we see that, for example, by looking at the budget deficit as a percentage of GDP. It was, don't quote me on this, I didn't double check the figure, but I'm pretty sure that, so I'll write this, but I'll say pretty sure to make sure you realize there's a caveat. Pretty sure that Hoover's biggest budget deficit was bigger than any in Bush's first term. This is a greater than sign. All right, and like I said, I wouldn't bet my life on that, but I'm pretty sure I dug that factoid up. And the reason that's significant is you've got guys like Paul Krugman explaining, you know, calling the governor, for example. Krugman had an op-ed one time referring to, the title of it was 50 Herbert Hoovers. Now, he might not have picked the title, but that phrase came from the column, so it's a fair title, even if Krugman didn't pick the title. I think 50 Herbert Hoovers, and he was complaining about how the governors of the 50 American states, once the recession kicked in 2008, had balanced budget requirements. And so they had to act like Krugman claimed, like Herbert Hoover did back in the Depression. And so Hoover was saying, or Krugman said, just like Herbert Hoover disastrously tried to balance the budget when he was in office during the Depression, and look what happened, so too we've got these idiots and governors, either because of their ideology or just because that's the way the rules are and they have to have a balanced budget, they can't run deficits at the state level. They're forced to cut spending precisely when, using Keynesian analysis, we know they should be increasing spending. We want to have bigger deficits when the economy's in trouble, not smaller ones. So what I did is, I said, wait a second, you know, it's one thing to say Herbert Hoover didn't run a big enough deficit, but to claim that you know, he was some kind of budget slasher and he was way too fiscally responsible as nuts. And that's why I think I went up and looked to see what was Hoover's biggest deficit, and it was his last year in office. And then I compared that to the George W. Bush first administration. So obviously Bush in the second term had a bigger one because he had all the TARP stuff right there at the end. But in the first 4 years when Bush was in office, I'm pretty sure the federal budget deficit as a percent of GDP was not higher ever in those first 4 years than it was at its height under Herbert Hoover. And so I pointed out that, you know, Krugman famously wrote that column, some of you may have seen, where he said, I'm going to switch to a fixed rate mortgage under George Bush because I'm so afraid of what's going to happen to interest rates once bond markets see, you know, this massive deficit spent under George Bush and how he's giving tax cuts to the rich while he's starting a war overseas. What a reckless guy this is. So it's just kind of funny that, you know, George W. Bush was the poster child for irresponsible government deficit spending in Krugman's mind, even in his first term, whereas Herbert Hoover is the poster child for austerity, when Hoover's budget deficit as a share of GDP was bigger than any under the first Bush administration years. Okay, so anyway, back to our story here. One of the indirect pieces of evidence for people who just can't believe it when you tell them Herbert Hoover was a big government guy. Herbert Hoover was not laissez-faire. Herbert Hoover in his memoirs proudly said how what he did was different from any of his predecessors. And remember my rhetorical point, if what we're trying to explain is what changed, why is it that we had all of these depressions with a small D, all of these panics in U.S. history, and none of them were that, you know, I mean, they were bad for the people involved, but it's not like they were so bad that we study them to this day. We don't learn about them in school. Most people don't know about the panic of 1907. Most people can't tell you about the Long Depression in the 1800s. So what changed? Why is it that we had all these things, but then all of a sudden, for some reason, the depression that started in 1929 or 1930, how come that thing was so awful? And then I pointed out, well, Herbert Hoover claims what he did was categorically, qualitatively different from anything anybody had done before him. And so it's a little bit, so it would make sense to say, oh, what changed was we take Hoover at his word and say the federal government tried all kinds of new medicine and the medicine was actually poison. That would make sense. What doesn't make much sense is to take the Paul Krugman approach and say, oh, the reason the depression was so awful was that Herbert Hoover didn't run big enough deficits. He didn't intervene enough. And again, the reason that doesn't make sense, even putting aside your knowledge of economics, is because then what you're basically saying is Herbert Hoover didn't deviate enough from his predecessors. So that doesn't make any sense. If you're trying to explain what changed, you can't explain that, oh, there wasn't a big enough change in federal policy. That doesn't make any sense. Okay, but people have been ingrained with this notion that Herbert Hoover was this tight-fisted, austere guy. They've been hammered with that so much that one way I try to get them to see that that's just false is to look at the 1932 Democratic platform, right? So in the 32 election, it's Franklin Delano Roosevelt running against Herbert Hoover, Hoover getting nominated by the Republicans for what would be his second term if he gets elected. And so that election occurs in November of 32. So in that campaign, the Democratic platform called for a 25% reduction in spending, and it called for a balanced budget, and it hilariously calls for a sound gold currency. And that those three planks are all hilarious because as soon as he gets into office, among one of his first acts, FDR takes the U.S. off gold, takes the dollar off gold, runs even bigger deficits than Hoover did. It increases spending pretty substantially. So that's what's kind of funny about those particular planks. But it wasn't just the Democratic platform. It was also FDR's stump speeches. He was running against Herbert Hoover as castigating Hoover as a profligate big spender, wasting the public's money when all the households have to, you know, scrimp and save. So it's my point is if if the stereotype were true, if Herbert Hoover really had been this small government laissez-faire kind of guy who just kept slashing spending to keep the budget balanced, that the economy's falling off a cliff, then you would think the charismatic FDR, who cares about the little guy, you would think he would run against this penny-pinching ogre in the White House, who for the last 4 years has been unwilling to open the purse strings and instead is listening to the advice of his fat cat advisor, Treasury Secretary Mellon. See what I mean? But that's not what FDR ran on. FDR ran on the reckless spending of Herbert Hoover and the huge budget deficits, the unheard of in peacetime, which was true. So just to clarify, the budget deficits that Herbert Hoover was running weren't the biggest in U.S. history during during World War I. The federal government had run up much bigger debts or deficits than was happening under Hoover, but the difference was the U.S. government was in a major war in those two cases, whereas here, Hoover was just, as a matter of economic policy, running these massive deficits. And so that's what FDR was running against, saying, in terms of peacetime, this guy is spending in an unprecedented fashion. That's why you've got to put me in charge, because I'll be more responsible with the public's money. Okay, let's move on. Yeah, I see someone asking a clarifying question. Right, that when I say budget deficits were bigger under Hoover than under the first Bush administration, obviously I mean as a percent of GDP, not in absolute dollar amounts. Okay. So the big thing for our point of view, what a lot of Austrians are going to remember, is that FDR, when he came in, one of the first things was the gold seizure. And so I've got here an image of a newspaper. I think that's, yeah, well, it's coming. What is this? I just grabbed this off of Google Image. I'm not sure if this was from a newspaper or what that is. But announcing that, except for a few, there are some exceptions, like if you were a dealer in antique coins or something and you had gold coins that were from some ship in the Spanish Armada or something like that, that had numismatic value, you didn't have to turn those things in. But if you were just holding gold as an investment, or just because you trusted gold and you didn't like paper currency or you didn't trust banks, you had to turn that stuff in. And it was, the penalties were enormous. And you could do serious prison time, and the fine was, I think, $10,000. And this was back when $10,000 was a lot of money. All right, so that's a big deal. What you might not know is that the gold storage at Fort Knox, the gold depository, was constructed to hold all the gold that the federal government seized. Okay, so it's, as I put it in the Great Depression book, if the government's going to steal everybody's gold, they got to put it somewhere. And so they built, so Fort Knox was already a military installation, but to build the gold depository there was done because they had to put the gold somewhere. So let me tell you about this first, and then let me talk about the gold clause, because I don't want to forget this. So this thing called gold clauses. Incidentally, also before I forget, let me just say this general announcement. What I'm doing in this lecture is hitting on a lot of the economic insight, the relevance of Austrian economics to these historical events. So this is not a history lecture. So I'm not going to, in this remaining time I have with you guys, I'm not going to go through and say, and then in 1936, the FDR brought up this particular measure, and then the Supreme Court said it was unconstitutional. So then there was the court packing, and then they came back and did this. I'm not going to do that, first of all, because I'm not a historian, and that's not my area of expertise. But also, the reading I gave you has all that stuff in. You can go see the chronology of events in the 1930s anywhere. My comparative advantage for you guys, and presumably why you're taking this course, is you want an Austrian economist from a Rothbardian perspective to comment on these things, to let you see it in a light that's not going to be presented in a standard history text. So that's what I'm doing here. So, if you were tuning in hoping I would lay out the chronology, let me just say you're not going to get that. If you want that stuff, it's in the readings I've given you, obviously. But in particular, that Larry Reed piece has a lot of the history. And, of course, if you get my book, you'll see it. But anyway, so that's what I'm doing here. So the tremendous importance of what happened here in early 1933 when FDR first comes in and he takes us off the gold standard is that he is severing the link between the U.S. dollar and gold. And so it doesn't go right to fiat currency, but he shatters the sacrosanct nature of the fact that up till then people thought the dollar was, $20.67 was an ounce of gold. I mean, it was actually defined in terms of different units of measurement, and historically the dollar had been defined in terms of silver, but nonetheless, for a long time, the dollar, $20.67, got you an ounce of gold, and that wasn't like a target or something. It wasn't like nowadays when Bernanke says, oh, the Federal Reserve is trying to keep price inflation between 1% and 2%. That's what our comfort zone is. That's what our target is. No, this was a legally binding pledge. This was, the government was legally obligated to do this. The reason people would come and give their gold to the government and get Federal Reserve notes or get Treasury certificates before that is that the government was saying to them, we will legally exchange these things. If you show up at any of our institutions with $20.67 in currency plus, a small handling fee, we'll give you an ounce of gold. And part of the reason for doing that was to get the dollar to have a certain purchasing power. Because if people didn't have that kind of guarantee, then people wouldn't trust the dollar as much. Right? So that's, I don't know if I stressed that when I talked to you guys about the classical gold standard. You might wonder, why did all these governments basically put handcuffs on themselves? Why would they do that? Or even in more recent times, in our day, when we see all of these troubles that these nations who adopted the euro, now they're in a sense subservient to the decisions made in Brussels, you might say, well, why did they do that? Why would you be so stupid as to give up your sovereignty and adopt the euro when you could have your own currency? Like the Greek government, why don't they just have the drachma? They could do whatever they want. Now they got to listen to a bunch of foreigners. Well, because you get better interest rates. And the same thing with under the classical gold standard, the reason if you were a government, you would tie the reason the French government would tie the franc to gold instead of just having it be a fiat currency is investors around the world, if everybody else is on gold, then the franc is going to constantly depreciate. And if someone's going to be lending money to people in France and they're going to get paid back in francs, they're going to insist on much higher interest rates because they got to worry about, well, gee, if the Bank of France starts cranking out francs, then the franc, dollar or franc pound or franc mark exchange rate is going to plummet, and so I'm going to get paid back in worthless currency. So if I'm going to make a loan to somebody, either I'm going to denominate it in something besides francs, or if it isn't francs, if what they owe me legally is 100,000 francs 3 years from now, and the Bank of France is not on the classical gold standard, then I'm going to insist on a much higher interest rate than I otherwise would. And this is the same thing in our day. Why did the Greek government go on the euro in the first place. It's because now it and other people in Greece were able to borrow at lower interest rates than when it was on the drachma. That's the whole point of why you would want to join a currency zone region that imposes some discipline on you if you are a government that has had a history of being irresponsible. Okay, so so anyway, back to our story. In 1933, the big change here is that citizens no longer could get gold for dollars. And then even when we go on, when we have the Bretton Woods arrangement, which is going to be put into place after World War II, and which will prevail until, depending on when you time it, into the late 60s, or for sure it dies in 1971. Even during Bretton Woods, normal citizens can't turn in dollars for gold. So make sure you guys realize that. At that point, it's only other central banks that can do it. So that's one of the big things that changes here. Whereas under the classical gold standard, anybody could turn in the relevant currency, or sorry, you know, the currency to the relevant issuing institution and get whatever the appropriate amount of gold was. So it wasn't just limited to central banks dealing with each other. Okay, so that's one thing. Now, so a lot of Austrians now will say things like, oh, you know, gold is the real money, and we've all been forced to use fiat currency. And if somebody who thinks that's paranoid says, oh, what are you talking about? You know, you can use gold right now for money. We can get into that discussion if you want. And strictly speaking, right now there's nothing on the books to prevent me from trying to use gold as money. And we can argue about they use other ways, like, you know, tax laws and stuff like that to hem you in. But the point is, there's something else that happened in 1933 when they did this. It wasn't merely that FDR made everybody turn in their gold and made it a crime for U.S. citizens to be holding gold. Because if you think about it, you could contract around that. Because the rest of the world, there was still an international gold market. Okay, so you still could look up in the Wall Street Journal or whatever and see what the world price of gold was. Even though you as an American now, you know, after FDR issues this executive order, weren't allowed to actually hold gold in your possession. So you might think, okay, well, couldn't Americans still effectively use gold as the real money and not the U.S. dollar if all of the contracts were denominated in gold? So, you know, I'm an employer, and I go to hire you, and you say, well, how much are you going to pay me per hour? And I say, well, I'm going to pay you in dollars because I can't hold gold. It's illegal. But the number of dollars I will give you will look up, like, every month. We'll go check and see what the world price of gold is, and we'll figure out how many dollars would you need to buy gold at the world price. And then that's how many dollars I'll give you. So, like, what I'm actually giving you is whatever. An ounce of gold per month is your salary if you take this job from me. But I'll pay you in dollars. But the point is, the number of dollars every month I give you is going to fluctuate, so that in principle, if you could take those dollars and go buy gold at the world price, even though it's illegal to do so, you'd get one gold ounce. And so, you know, if you just think through the logic of that, if every contract were written in that way, especially long-term debt contracts, right? So if somebody said, okay, I'm going to borrow $1,000 from you at 10% interest for 10 years, and so I'll pay you the 10% interest each year, and then after 10 years, I'll give you $1,000 back. And then someone says, oh, but wait a minute, the U.S. isn't on gold anymore. I'm a little bit leery about the dollar. The contract could say, oh, after the 10 years are up, you're actually not giving me $1,000. What you're giving me is as many gold ounces as today $1,000 would get you, if that makes sense. So, yeah, you're not paying me in gold, you're paying me in dollars, but the number of dollars you're going to owe me, we're going to check at that time when you have to go to pay me, and we're going to look at the world price of gold in dollars and then figure out, okay, to give me the right number of gold ounces back, that's how many dollars you owe me at that time. So that way, you know, if people even said today, okay, and let's use today when we're picking these numbers, let's assume that the gold price is actually $20.67 an ounce. You know, in a sense, they could contract around everything that Washington was doing. They say, yeah, we let them do what they want. We're all going to conduct our business as if the dollar is still tied to gold at $20.67, and that's how we'll do it. And so, I mean, there would still be friction because there would still be spot prices, and, you know, not everybody can write a contract for everything that's going to cover every transaction that's ever going to happen. But the point is they could shield themselves and lock in things. You get what I'm saying? I don't want to belabor the point too much, but I want to make sure you guys understand that just seizing everybody's gold, if the only thing the government had done was to confiscate everyone's gold at gunpoint and say you can't hold it, there's a lot that free individuals can do to respond to that, to limit the impact of that. And so everybody in his or her head could still be thinking gold is really the money, and they could conduct their affairs like that. So that's why this thing is, to me, is almost more offensive than seizing the gold. I mean, they're both pretty offensive, but in terms of getting people to stop using gold as the money and to start using the dollar as the money, end of story, I think this thing is pretty significant that they outlawed gold clauses. Okay, so if you had a contract and you said, I'm lending you, $2,067 today, which is the equivalent of 100 ounces of gold, and then 10 years from now, I want you to pay me whatever number of dollars 2,500 ounces of gold at that time entitles me. When 10 years go by, that contract is not legally enforceable because the government is saying, no, gold clauses are illegal. And so the guy who owes me the money can just pay me. To be honest, now that I'm going down this path, I don't know if they were just saying we're not going to enforce gold clauses or if they were saying if we catch anyone even putting that language in a contract, you're in trouble. So for sure they wouldn't enforce it, but I don't know if they because in other words, presumably if people are going to make a contract, both parties want to use, you know, they could just trust each other and say we understand. But again, it kind of defeats the point of having a legally binding contract if the other party realizes he can just pay you back a lot less and there's nothing you can do about it. All right, so. Anyway, I don't know off the top of my head if it was merely that they wouldn't enforce gold clauses or if they caught two mutually consenting parties calculating their liabilities to each other based off of looking up the gold price, if that was a crime too. I'm not sure. But for sure, gold clauses were – the way I've seen it described in the literature is to say gold clauses were illegal. So to me, that sounds like it was a crime just to even put it in the contract. But in any event, for sure they didn't enforce it. And that didn't change, I believe, until the 1970s. Maybe the 60s, but I think it wasn't until the 70s where you could once again put gold clauses back in contracts. So just what I'm trying to get across here is what FDR did was unbelievable in terms of the scope of it and the invasion of economic freedom and just the full scale assault on gold as money to be replaced by people using the dollar as money and thinking in terms of the dollar is the end of the explanation. That when you think of money, you think of the U.S. dollar. You don't take it one step and say, well, because the dollar is tied to gold, and so really I ultimately have, you know, this backstop of gold coinage, that was really severed by all the stuff that they did starting in 1933. Okay, so what actually happened, remember, up until this point, for many years, the formal definition of what you would get if you turned in a certain amount of gold worked out to about $20.67 per ounce. And so that was suspended. And then there was a while there where FDR, literally off the top of his head, would make up what the gold price was going to be that day. There's a famous thing, Henry Morgenthau was like FDR's, one of his top closest confidants or whatever, and he was meeting with him. And there's a famous thing where he comes in and asks FDR, okay, like, what are we targeting to be the dollar price of gold right now? And FDR just picked a number because he said, oh, that's a lucky number. Do that. And so then Morgenthau goes home and writes in his diary, you know, if anybody knew what we were doing to target the price of gold, you know, they'd be horrified. I'm paraphrasing. Okay, so in 1934, gold once again, they went back to, you know, having a locked-in price is what I'm getting at. So in early 33, one of his earliest acts, FDR seizes the gold, and so then the gold price is fluctuating based on FDR's wins of the day. But then in 1934, they have another act that locks in the price of gold now at $35 an ounce. And that's what it's going to be all through Bretton Woods. All right, so it's, which remember was formally ended in 1971 under Richard Nixon. So if you look at charts of the U.S. dollar price of an ounce of gold, you'll see like two very long horizontal lines, one at $20.67 up until 33, and then it's going to jump up to 35 and stay there until 1971. Now, if you look at it, if you know, you zoom in and look at it, it bounces around. So, I mean, gold still was a commodity on the world markets, and so it could deviate from these things. It's just, again, if the government is legally obligated to redeem dollars for gold or vice versa at these respective prices, then arbitrage is going to make sure the market price doesn't deviate too much one way or the other. Just like if you looked at foreign exchange markets from a far enough vantage point, it would look like the dollar against the pound was $4.86 all during the classical gold standard. But if you zoomed in, you would see it bounce around. And if it went too high one way, then gold would get shipped from one country to another. If it went too much the other way, and so forth. Okay. So incidentally, some people like to look at this as an example of just what a bunch of criminals the Roosevelt administration was, because think about what they did. At gunpoint, they had everybody turn in their gold, and they gave them $20.67. So I probably should have clarified that. In the administration's rhetoric and stuff, they weren't seizing anybody's gold. It wasn't like they just went up and grabbed your car and said, ah, it's our car now. They were taking everybody's gold and then giving them the equivalent amount of dollars. Okay? So in their mind, no, it's just one asset swap for another. And, of course, they had all kinds of rhetoric about, oh, we're doing this because speculators are attacking the dollar, blah, 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 whatever. And so we got to we got to take these emergency measures to fight the Depression. So now the government is holding all of this gold, and then it goes ahead and revalues gold at $35 an ounce. So that's a neat trick, if you think about it. They get everyone to turn in all this physical metal and give everybody $12.67 per ounce, and then 1 year later, they just decree, okay, now gold is worth $35 an ounce, which we all happen to be holding right now. So they just earned a pretty big increase on their portfolio of gold in, you know, about a year. So just think through the logic of that. That's pretty creepy. So when you see people say stuff like, the administration devalued gold, devalued the dollar by 40% or whatever. That's what they're getting at. Okay, now, so look at this. This is interesting. Remember, these events happened, this taking the dollar off gold, in Roosevelt comes in March of 1933 is when he's inaugurated. Because remember, back then, new presidents were still elected in November of the prior year, and then the lame duck session, if you will, extended through March, and that's when the new presidents got inaugurated. It wasn't until later the inauguration got moved up to January. Okay, so FDR doesn't even get into office until March of 1933 and picks the U.S. up gold. And so look at this. So this is the monetary base. So this is the literal currency, paper money, held by the public and commercial bank reserves, either in the vault or on deposit with the Fed. So that's something that the Fed can directly control. Whether the public takes its money out of the banks or not, they can't change the monetary base. They can change M1, they can change M2, they can't change the monetary base. The monetary base is strictly controlled by the Fed. So you can see here, it actually dipped down a little bit, 30 to 30, throughout 1930, and then it starts rising pretty rapidly, and then dips down, okay, rising, and then boom, look at this. And that happens right when FDR does this action. So the way mainstream economists who like what FDR did are going to interpret this as saying FDR unshackled the Fed's hands, that they couldn't inflate adequately beforehand because the U.S. was still on the gold standard, and that's the whole point of the gold standard, is it makes it so you can't inflate too much, because if you overstep and then everyone starts turning in the dollars for gold, then your gold reserves go out the door. But once FDR suspended the dollar's redeemability in gold, all bets are off, and so now the Fed is free to put in a huge burst of inflation. And like I say, that's what proponents of the move would say. Because they would say, following Milton Friedman, oh, part of the reason the Great Depression was so awful in the early 30s is prices kept falling. We didn't have enough monetary inflation to offset that. If only the Fed would have inflated more, why didn't they? Oh, the stupid gold standard. So thank goodness FDR was smart enough to take us off gold and allow this recovery to finally kick in. And you can see what they're saying. So this is the consumer price index. So this is pretty amazing. So this is the level. This is not, these aren't percentage changes. This is just saying, like, this is the average of the price of the bundle of consumer goods. So you can see how it's very stable in the 20s. That's partly why Irving Fisher was so optimistic. Right around here. Let's see. This is 29, this is about where 1930 would be. So this would be the late 1929. So right in this area is where Irving Fisher famously said U.S. stocks have achieved a permanently high plateau. And why? Because among other things, looking backwards, U.S. prices were basically flat for the last 2 years, and actually more if you kept going back. So Irving Fisher in late 1929 said, oh, the Federal Reserve has done a great job maintaining the purchasing power of the dollar. What more could you want? Crash happens. People start running to banks. Banks are failing. Everyone's hoarding money. The Fed is not inflating enough because of that silly gold standard tying its hands. And so you see the price level dropping rapidly. And so, this is an index. And then look at this. In early 33, it just turns around on a dime. And you look at that rapid descent. and then turns right around, and you say, what happened right there, that inflection point? That's when FDR took the dollar off gold. And you can see that jump in the price level. And then from that point on, it's gently rising. So to sum up, consumer prices have been falling rapidly from the moment of the stock market crash up until the inauguration of FDR, when he takes the dollar of gold. And then they turn around on a dime, jump up a little bit, and then from that point on start gently rising. Now, I zoomed in here. You'll notice, I don't want to mislead you guys and send you out of here with the wrong idea. I stopped this at 1937. If we pull back, they fall again in between 37 and 38. So I'm not saying to you that prices kept rising continually throughout the New Deal. I'm just saying from 33 to 37, they were gently rising. So, you know, from one perspective, somebody who doesn't like price inflation, you could say that this chart is evidence of what a bunch of crooks those guys were. Because they took everybody's gold, then they started running the printing press, and so now the American public is getting hit with a double whammy. Not only is the economy bad, but now prices are rising too. So if you were somebody, you know, living on a fixed income, if you had a bunch of bonds, or if you were just sitting on cash for some reason, or if you were receiving a pension that was denominated in dollars, now all of a sudden the cost of living keeps going up on top of the economy being awful. But mainstream economists think it's great. So mainstream economists love the heart, the price inflation from 1933 onward. And that makes sense because following in the tradition of Milton Friedman, let me clarify too, some of you might be wondering, so wait a minute, why do you keep saying mainstream economists and then referring to Milton Friedman? Shouldn't you be saying mainstream monetarists or mainstream Chicago school economists, because surely the Keynesians disagree with what Milton Friedman said, not on this issue. So even Krugman, and DeLong, if you know who those guys are Friedmanites on Fed inflation in the 1930s. Right, so what I mean is, it's not just Chicago School free market followers of Milton Friedman who think the reason the 1930s were so awful is that the Fed didn't inflate enough. That this is now the mainstream position among economists, and Austrians are in the very small minority I should even say Rothbardians are in the very small minority for thinking that the Fed deflation was not the issue. And the reason I just clarified it, said narrowed it to Rothbardians, is there's even many self-proclaimed Austrian economists today who would say something like, yeah, the Federal Reserve caused the bubble in the 20s and caused the crash, but then it sort of kicked the economy when it was already down by not inflating enough and maintaining nominal GDP or not maintaining aggregate expenditures, or, you know, it would depend on how they would classify. And there's even some, depending on what period of his life you're looking at, even Friedrich Hayek has said things to this effect. So he wasn't saying it at the time. When he was in the thick of it, Hayek and Robbins were saying, whoa, these central banks are trying to inflate our way out of this depression. That's nutty. So that's what Hayek and Robbins were saying in the early 1930s. But later on in their lives, Robbins sort of explicitly disavowed what he said that I've quoted for you guys. You know, his book on the Great Depression, the later Lionel Rodman's, you know, kind of disavowed a lot of that and said, no, I've changed my mind. And Hayek also, and again, I'm not making fun of him, but if you guys have read Hayek, you know, it's no surprise that there's a whole cottage industry of what did Hayek really mean by that, right? Because he's so analytical and let's consider this industry. Let's, what about this point? What about this? But sometimes you don't know what the heck his point is. So somebody who wanted to argue that Friedrich Hayek thought the Fed should have inflated more in the early 30s to mitigate the depression could find textual support for that statement. I'll put it that way. So whereas Murray Rothbard was that's nonsense, that by, you know, printing money doesn't make the community wealthier, it just redistributes wealth from everybody else to the people with the printing press. So not only was FDR a criminal on all these other accounts, but then by taking the dollar off gold and printing more money, he was, you know, stealing from all these people who had dollar-denominated forms of wealth. Okay, having said all that, though, let me just throw one thing out at you, because the part of the difficulty is it does look like the economy really did turn around right when FDR did this. And there's a couple things you could say. So I know Mark Thornton, for example, points out that FDR ended alcohol prohibition. And so, and in fact, you know, for those of you on Facebook who are plugged into the libertarian community, just a couple days ago, I guess was the anniversary of when it happened, there were photos circulating about people throwing back beers because now it was legal again to drink. So that, and it's not even, we're not saying that to be funny. It's not like we're saying, oh yeah, everyone can go get hammered now, and so happy times are here again. I mean, if you haven't looked into it, I mean, there's very convincing economic arguments for why something as major as prohibiting alcohol would have very serious economic impacts, and that it would make sense that if they legalized it, even conventional measures of economic health would improve. Another possibility is just everybody knew under Herbert Hoover things were awful, and then FDR comes in, and maybe that was just a psychological trigger. You know, in other words, at some point businesses have to start investing again, have to hire back more workers, and it could just be a focal point that, well, when this new guy comes in who's going to have a brand new start and he's very charismatic and gives all kinds of good speeches, at some point, you know, the economy has to bottom out and turn around. It always has in the past. Why would it do it right when FDR came in? Again, it wouldn't be crazy to suggest, well, maybe it's just because the old guy who was clearly awful was out and the new guy came in. But I think it's also fair to say that given the high wage policies of Hoover and then FDR, price inflation could increase employment. Okay, so let me just read that again. My writing's not the best. So given the high wage policies of both Herbert Hoover and then FDR was going to ramp it up, price inflation actually could lead to higher employment. So let me just say that in different words. Last week when I was talking about the Hoover administration and was trying to explain why was it so bad, why did unemployment get to be so high and why did it stay high for so long, one of the main arguments, bits of evidence that we used was that for some reason, real wages went up during that first phase. From 1929 to 1933, real wages went up. So in other words, if you held on to your job after the stock market crash and then the economy's falling apart, the paycheck you got from your employer month after month was able to buy you more and more stuff at the store. So from an employer's perspective, labor hours kept getting more and more expensive as the Depression wore on. And again, that was because we don't know why. I mean, we have theories as to why wages seem to be stickier during this period than they were like from 1920 to 21. But what's undeniable is that they were. So here, back looking at the CPI chart, as prices are falling, this is the general price level, if you will, prices of a basket of consumer goods and services, they're falling at a pretty steep rate. Nominal wages weren't falling that fast. And so the point is, if you held on to your job, either your wages weren't falling at all, or they were falling, but they were falling more slowly than prices at the grocery store. And so as time wore on, you could get more and more. And so again, from the employer's perspective, what that meant is, ironically and tragically, even as unemployment goes from whatever, 5% up to 25%, labor kept getting more expensive. So that's, as far as just basic supply and demand economics, when you're trying to understand why did unemployment keep going up, why weren't employers hiring, why would you hire when business is awful and labor keeps getting more expensive in real terms? So given that, let's go back to that chart, if there's these institutional rigidities, if for some reason, and we can argue that Hoover probably had a lot to do with it, but if for whatever reason wages weren't able to fall in the early 30s the way they had fallen in prior depressions or panics, well, if FDR comes in and causes the price level to start rising, now real wages are getting lower. As this trend continues, it gets cheaper and cheaper to hire workers because there's no reason for nominal wages to keep rising as much as the prices would. It's just they were sticky downward, as the Keynesians would like to say. All right, so what I'm arguing is I don't think it's a sellout of Austrian economics or libertarianism to entertain the possibility that given that the federal government had all these policies in place and that unions were doing such and such, and we just had this crazy situation where there was a drop in productivity and prices were falling and nominal wage rates were either stuck or they were there was a lot of friction that was preventing them from falling quickly. If what you want to do is make the official employment rate go up or the unemployment rate go down, printing up a bunch of money and getting it into people's hands so they can go spend it and raise prices actually might make that problem temporarily better. So it doesn't mean that would be the optimal solution. The optimal solution would be to figure out how come nominal wages aren't falling like they always had before and then fix that so that they can fall and clear the market again. And also, it's not even a long-run solution that printing a bunch of money might temporarily, because what happens is you print a bunch of money and raise prices, you're getting workers to work for less compensation. And so this is part of what the early Keynesians were calling the money illusion, and were saying it's a good thing. Like, in other words, we can't get the workers to take an explicit wage cut, even though that would help clear the labor market, so we'll fool them. They still think they're getting paid the same, but actually everything's getting more expensive. So they actually are taking a wage cut, but the unions are too stupid to realize it. Well, eventually the unions are going to catch on to that, and they'll build in cost of living adjustments to their contracts. So even the temporary boost you might get from a burst of, especially if it's unexpected inflation, eventually is going to peter out. But the point is, when we're trying to understand, oh, gee, how come those conventional statistics apparently turned around on a dime when FDR came in, I think it's fine to acknowledge, sure, if for some reason wages are sticky because of all the other stuff the government's doing, printing a bunch of money can temporarily alleviate that. Okay, let me see what do we got here as far as timing. Okay. I may carry some of these slides over until next day. Yeah, we'll see how it goes. Okay, so the bank holiday, again, I'm just going to be very brief here. I mean, there's a ton you could say about this in terms of the history. I just want to say that it's from a Rothbardian perspective, the government was protecting fractional reserve banks. That's the fundamental Rothbardian point on this. That, you know, so when the group that calls themselves the free bankers, when they say that, oh no, you know, fractional reserve banking is a market outcome, and the you Rothbardians have to 100% reserve bankers have to explain to us, you know, how come the market keeps choosing this, and so this is one of the things that the Rothbardian will say. No, it's not a free market, because when the banks do get into massive trouble, when the public does en masse show up and say, give us our money back, the government will just come in and suspend redemption and just say, no, the banks don't have to follow their contracts, even though you're supposed to be able to get your money and they don't have it because it's a fractional reserve bank. By definition, they don't have all your money on hand. And that's what's called bank holiday. So this term holiday is quite the euphemism. What it meant was the banks all shut down, and so if you had your money at the bank and wanted to get it out, you couldn't until the government opened the bank back up. Okay, here, so I took this from the Larry Reed piece. One of the things among the other horrors of the New Deal was that the Agricultural Adjustment Act sought to raise prices for farmers, so to raise crop prices and to raise the price for cattle and chickens and stuff like that. So the long-run solution was to pay farmers not to plant, right? So the point is to restrict supply so you get the prices to go up. Because remember, the context of this, prices had been falling. And this is causing what Irving Fisher called the debt deflation cycle. So farmers owed fixed mortgage payments to the bank, for example, you know, because they might have borrowed money from the bank to buy a tractor or to buy fertilizer or whatever. And then they're going to plant their stuff. The harvest is going to come. They're going to sell their crops on the market and then pay the bank back. Or, you know, make the installment payment on its mortgage for the farm in terms of the real estate. And those are fixed dollar payments because it's a fixed rate mortgage. So now if all of a sudden crop prices fall 40% over the course of a few years, you as the family farmer are devastated because now your revenues drop 40%, but you still owe the bank the same monthly payments in dollar terms. So then the bank's going to foreclose on you. And you see the problem. So among other things so this started under the Hoover administration, but FDR just upped the ante, just made it more so. The point was the administration wanted to raise farm prices, agricultural prices. And so how do you do that? Well, you restrict supply. There's other things that they would do too, and Hoover did it, in terms of the government coming in and buying wheat and then, you know, putting it in silos until it started rotting and stuff like that. So, I mean, there's all kinds of crazy stuff the federal government was doing that was awful from an economic efficiency standpoint to try to raise prices for farmers. But so the thing that ultimately worked is to restrict supply. Because the problem was, let me clarify that. They realized just trying to boost demand by the federal government saying we're going to enter the market and buy to raise prices to a target level, that didn't work because that would just bring in more farmers, right? So if the government comes in and says we're going to set a floor price for a bushel of wheat, and if the market demand for wheat isn't big enough to keep the price at that level, we, the federal government, will step in and we'll buy wheat and put it in silos to prop up the price. They tried that stuff under the Hoover administration, but the problem was they start stockpiling all this wheat, and then farmers start planting more wheat because now they know they have a guaranteed price. So they stop planting the stuff that the government's not putting a floor under, and they start planting the stuff that they know they have a guaranteed buyer in the form of Uncle Sam. So that just led to this crazy situation where the government keeps stockpiling all of these targeted commodities, and they start rotting in silos. And so then they went, you know, they might say, okay, we can't do that anymore, and then they dump it on the market, and the price falls way below what it would have been in the market, you know, had the government done nothing. And so it ended up exacerbating price swings and making the situation more volatile, and it made the problem worse, where now they encourage more people to take out loans from banks to, you know, plant wheat or whatever, and then when the harvest came, the price might be way lower than they thought it was going to be because the government stopped the program. So, I mean, it was awful. So they realized this isn't working. We can't help the farmers by being the backstop of their demand and just using tax dollars to keep buying their product because that's just going to pull more farmers into the market. What we want to do is restrict supply. So they're going to start paying farmers to not plant wheat. And that's the way you get wheat prices up. So there's issues with that too, and there's hilarious stuff. If you guys are familiar with the book Catch 22, and that's where the phrase a Catch 22 comes from, by Joseph Heller. So if you take nothing else away from this course, I would recommend it. It's a novel, and it's a classic anti-war sort of government absurdity novel. Some people. My college roommate, his favorite book was Orwell's 1984, until I mentioned this book to him, and then he told me, oh, this is my new favorite book. So that's the kind of book this is. But it's absolutely hilarious, and he's one of the characters' father was a guy who his living was to get money from the federal government to not plant crops. Like that's what his job was to not plant things. And then there was a funny thing where, you know, it said he would wake up at the crack of noon instead of the crack of dawn, and then begin his day of not planting soybeans, not planting wheat, not, you know, stuff like that. So, funny stuff. So, but the thing that was horrifying about it was when they made this transition, when they decided we need to restrict supply, obviously the most efficient way to do that is to not plant stuff in the first place or to not breed more pigs or whatever. But in the meantime, they had all of these crops on hand, and they had a bunch of pigs or whatever, and so they decided right now we just have to destroy all this stuff. So they literally destroyed food. They literally slaughtered millions of baby pigs, even though people were starving. The government is there destroying food, even as other Americans are literally starving, because in their mind, we got to raise prices. And it was too late for this cycle to get the farmers and the cattle ranchers or whatever to cut back. And so, you know, so they weren't, throughout the 1930s, it's not like they were continually every year killing pigs. Because eventually they were just paying the farmers not to, you know, maintain such big populations. I don't know what you call a pig population. Okay, but the point is, when they first decided to go into this full steam ahead, they already had all these gluts of, in their mind, these gluts of food and pigs and whatever on hand, and so they said, well, just destroy them. And so there's some funny stuff where they had, you know, so the farm animals had to drag the, you know, the plows to plow under the corn and wheat and cotton and stuff like that. Okay, so in other words, they were being asked to do things that they had never been asked to do before. Because when you're normally running a farm, you wouldn't do that, because then that's going to destroy your harvest next year. And who knows if this is true or not, but there was an anecdote saying that, you know, like the guys from the federal government would come around and the mule, you know, was trying to get the mule to plow under the crops, and the mule wouldn't do it. And he's, you know, smacking the mule and trying to get it to do it. And so the joke is that, you know, the ass knew more about agriculture than the guy from the government did, you know, that kind of thing. All right, let's see. I'm just going to go right ahead and finish this out, and then I'll just answer your guys' questions. If you either want to come Saturday to the office hours, you can ask me there, or I'll post it. Because with the time we got remaining, I can finish these slides. I think it's better just to do that and get this topic out of the way. So next one, we're looking at this cartels, the National Industrial Recovery Act, the NIRA. Again, there's all kinds of great anecdotes and things you can read about this in terms of the history to give you some color and flavor. That's not what I'm doing in this lecture, obviously. Amity Schley's book, The Forgotten Man, has some great stuff on this. But what it was, from an economic point of view, was a big cartelization scheme. And so there were more than 500 industries were designated, and then the government would anoint certain big players within each industry to set what were called codes of, quote, fair competition. And the government was happy with that so long as it could be demonstrated that the monopoly rents that these big businesses were getting were being passed along to their workers. So what these codes of fair competition meant were things like, you know, the dominant firm in an industry, like if it was the tire industry, you know, like some Firestone being a national company had a national reputation if you wanted to buy tires. And so if you're some little mom and pop organization trying to make tires locally, how can you compete with Firestone? You can charge a lower price, but not if there's a code of fair competition, because then the government lets Firestone write the code. And Firestone sets a floor price and says you cannot charge less than such and such for, you know, four tires of these kind of specifications, because to do so would be unfair because you'd be undercutting your brother and sister in the business, or you know, get what I'm saying? So the idea was they were trying to eliminate cutthroat competition, but really what it meant was the big businesses in each industry got to raise prices. And they could get away with it, so they would benefit. So think about it. If prices in general go up and consumers are forbidden from paying less than a certain floor price, who is that going to help? It's going to help the dominant firm in the industry because they're the ones that, you know, have the highest quality product or whatever. You know, they people are willing to pay a little bit more for the name brand because it's the name brand. And for other reasons too, like if it's like a national tire distributor, because then you know you can go to various places around the country and have, you know what you're getting, that kind of stuff. So if you're just some no-name mom-and-pop organization trying to compete with the big boys, you can have better customer service and stuff like that. But another huge way you compete is to have a lower price, and so that's why somebody might give you a chance. But now they're going to make this illegal. And so what economists found, and this is summarized in that op-ed that I had you guys read, is that if you looked at wages in industries that had one of these codes of fair competition compared to, because some industries didn't, and if you go, there's actually, you know, they haven't, the Ohanian and Lee paper, or Cole, I'm getting their first and last names mixed up, the guys who wrote the op-ed, they have an academic paper that they were just summarizing in plain English on the op-ed. But their academic paper, if you're curious, go Google for that and find it. It's really neat. Like there was, for some technical reasons, there were industries that were, that, or they're like within the same industry even, there was a very similar thing about one type of mining operation that was covered under the code of fair competition, but because of some quirk, the other one wasn't. And so it was like miners who were getting one type of coal were covered, but miners getting this other type of coal were not covered. And so they looked at the wages of those two groups over time, and it was a pretty good, you know, longitudinal study in terms of the econometrics or whatever. And you could see that, and the reason it was a really good experiment, so to speak, is that it was just a quirk in the way, I can't remember off the top of my head, but it was just a quirk in the way the legislation was worded or something, or the court ruling, that the one group was covered and the one other one wasn't. And so it was really good in terms of hold everything else equal and just tweak the one little thing as much as could be hoped for in the social sciences. and they saw a huge difference in the progression of wage rates for those miners in those two separate lines. And so, so anyway, when I'm just saying to you, when they say stuff like manufacturing wage is 25% higher, they're getting that number by, you say, well, compared to what? They don't just mean they looked at the thing before the NRA went into effect and then they looked at it later. They were controlling for, you know, other variables, and they were kind of like using their model to try to predict, in terms of regression analysis, what would the wages have been like in the absence of this thing, and then compared to this. So anyway, that's partly what they did. So when you're trying to understand these types of figures, when we say, hey, did the New Deal get us out of the Depression like everybody tells us? And I'll wrap this up in 2 minutes, guys. You can just give me two more minutes, and I know I'm over time here. So the New Deal get us out of the Depression, because that's what people tell us. Like, oh, yeah, I love FDR. He got us out of the Depression. Well, some of these figures are amazing, that if you look at total private hours worked per adult compared to their level in 1929, they were down during the Hoover years from 1930 to 32, down 18%. But if you look at the New Deal era from 33 to 39, they were actually 27% lower. So, and that might surprise you, because you can see how unemployment actually went up a little bit. And part of what's going on there, if you're trying to reconcile those two figures, and wait a minute, how can the unemployment rate have gotten a little bit better under FDR than under Hoover, and yet these figures seem to be showing that the employment situation was worse under FDR? Well, there's two things. One is, you know, the population's rising, but also, remember, unemployment means people who are trying to seek work, and also, this is total hours. So it's not saying how many people had jobs. It's saying how many hours did they work. So part of what's happening here is fewer people would be, relative to the whole population, trying to even get a job in the first place, so they wouldn't count as unemployed. But also, in terms of the hours worked, there was work sharing schemes, right? So if you were a businessman, you were getting pressure from the unions or from the government. You know, your costs are going up, your revenues are going down. You're getting a lot of pressure not to lay off workers because you're an awful person. The union might flip it. So instead, you spread the work around. So everybody works 10% fewer hours, but they all keep their job, instead of you laying off 10% of your worst workers, which is what normally would happen. You'd let the people who are the dead weight, the dead wood, go, and you keep your best workers and have them working full-time still, or even working more to pick up the slack. That didn't happen. You weren't allowed, but you were strongly encouraged not to lay off people. And so one way to fix that or to deal with that, if you're an employer, is to spread the work around. And so everybody's working fewer hours. So that's partly also what explains this. Okay, last thing, and I'll let you guys go here. Look at these statistics. My point is, in what sense could you possibly say that FDR got us out of the Depression? So he gets sworn in March of 33. Where the unemployment rate for that year is basically 25%, and you can say, okay, that's because of Herbert Hoover, fine. And okay, yeah, it goes down. But let me look at 4 years later, it's still 14.3%, which is horrendous. And then in the next year, it bounces back up to 19%, and then it starts falling. So the point is, from 33 to 30 or to 1940, that 7-year stretch, the unemployment rate was never in single digits, and the lowest it actually ever got to be was 14.3%, which is horrible. And remember, most depressions or panics in the U.S. were basically done with after 2 years. And so what I argued in my book was to say, what would the numbers have to look like if I wanted to make the case that the New Deal prolonged the Great Depression and made it agonizing, wouldn't the numbers look like this? I mean, so it's the mystery. If FDR had come into office and then 2 years later unemployment was back down to 6% or something and the economy was fine, that wouldn't prove FDR did a good thing, because that's what happened throughout all of U.S. history. The mystery is, why didn't that happen? Okay. Well, let me stop there, guys. Thanks for tuning in, and some of you I may see you tomorrow during the office hours.